entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
American Graffiti. Where were you in 62?
Grab that special one and jump into your candy-colored custom or your screaming machine, cruise downtown, and catch American Graffiti.
American Graffiti.
Baby, what's that?
It's a movie.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Go back in time.
Where were you in 62?
Is that you in that beautiful car? Jeez, what a waste of machinery.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around 10 o'clock tonight.
What did you say?
Someone wants me. Someone roaming the streets wants me.
And I bet you're smart enough to get us some brew.
A ballpoint pen, a pint of old Harper.
Okay, you got an ID for the liquor?
Not, I left it in the car.
You'll have to get it before.
I forgot the car.
We're finally getting out of this turkey camp. You just can't stay 17 forever.
If you ever get tired of going steady with somebody that ain't around, I'm up for grabs.
If I had a boyfriend, he'd pound you.
Get your boogaloos out, baby. The Wolfman is everywhere.
16 candles. Chain one!
You know Toby Juarez?
We killed him last night.
Excuse me, I think we've had an accident.
Well, I won't report you this time, but next time, just watch it, will you?
Standard, man. I can dig it.
It's one of those great old movies about romance, racing, and rock and roll.
Oh, American Graffiti. American Graffiti. Where were you in 62?
Hey, this is Chip Foose, and you're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Rock on.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers in Google Town Talk, 1340.com, and you can see me live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. And if you've missed any of our 730-some-odd shows, you can visit NostalgicRadioAndCars.com, where they're all stored. Good evening, Ed. How are you?
Doing all right? Survived the storm?
Survived the storm, yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to talk about that for a few minutes, but let me just tell you about some of the shows that are going to be taking place here. Obviously, we had the commercial for flacarshows.com. That's everything in Florida. But my good friends at Festivals of Speed are doing an event this weekend, and it is in just outside of Atlanta. Should be interesting to see what it looks like up there. And it's called Avalon, and it's probably 200-some-odd cars, very nicely done, outside, on a nice street, and kind of in an upscale area. So that should be a lot of fun. These car shows that take place on streets now are relatively popular, And I'm not sure about this one, but very often most of them are open to the public. Some of them are fenced off. I know the Cars on the Fifth down in Naples, but Festivals of Speed does one in Naples. If you visit festivalsofspeed.com, you can find out about all the shows. Also, we have one coming up here shortly at the Mission Inn in Howie in the Hills, which is really a nice place to just take your sweetie and enjoy the weekend and then come out and visit us at FOS, Festivals of Speed, and check out some really cool cars and meet some interesting people. And then, of course, we got the Chattanooga Concourse. That's coming up next weekend. This weekend is also the Audrain Concourse in Newport, Rhode Island. I was scheduled to be there, but the impending storm kind of had a little issue. Created a little issue for me, so I decided to pass on it. But I am going to go to with my good friends and team Festivals of Speed to Atlanta, and I will be judging up there and probably helping out with MC duties. Somebody said I had a gift to talk, so I don't know. Face for radio, as they say. Nonetheless, and then, of course, the Barber Motorsports Vintage Festival is next weekend also, I believe. And then this weekend, this Sunday, for all us local gearheads and parts junkies, we have the Sumter Swap Meet. Now, we're going to get the owner of the Sumter Swap Meet on our show. If you're familiar with Moultrie, Georgia, and the big Moultrie Swap Meet, that gentleman was involved. He's actually got the owner, the gentleman that started the Moultrie Swap Meet, was in the car business for a long time. He's got an amazing collection of combination of drag cars, early 60s drag cars. He's pretty much a Chevy guy, but he does have some Fords. Drag cars and some NASCARs, Winston Cup cars, if you will. And so I was invited up there to go check out his collection. Not sure if I'm going to be able to do it this weekend because I think they're going to be on their way down here. So we'll be like two ships passing in the night. Speaking of ships passing in the night, I'm sure there was a lot of ships out there passing all over the area. That storm was very unusual. We were lucky. We didn't get a ton of rain, but what we did get was a tidal surge. So all my friends over near Tampa Bay on the beaches, hey, my heart goes out to you guys. But I will say this, and this is a shameless plug for me, since you guys all know I do appraisals and valuations on automobiles, diminished value, which is if your car's been crashed and fixed, it's not worth what it was before the accident. So someone has to write those valuations so that you can get fully indemnified by the at-fault insured, which means compensate you not only for the damage to your vehicle, the rental car that they owe you, the what should be a comparable to what you're driving vehicle, I might add, but also the loss of the value of your vehicle. Because if your car was a $50,000 car before the accident, it's going to be about a $40,000 car after the accident because of the Carfax. You know, Carfax is a double-edged sword. It works good when you're trying to buy. It works bad if you're trying to sell. Because people, I mean, it doesn't matter what it is today. In fact, I can recall being at an auction working with Mike at Hollywood Wheels when we were up in Amelia Island, and we had a number of cars that were, I'm going to say 60s, 70s vintage. Maybe there was a few 80s cars there, but I actually had a gentleman walk up to me and say, do you have a Carfax on that 80-something, whatever it was, Banzai Toto Special? And I said, sir, the Carfaxes, and I can tell you this from experience because I've had some 80s cars and I've ran Carfaxes on them. The Carfax doesn't really show up until sometime in the mid-90s. So whatever happened before that, if you pull a Carfax on a vehicle, like I do that a lot for when I'm doing my valuations, it'll tell me the usually where the vehicle was sold, the in-service date, which means when, you know, the car might have been built in May, but it wasn't sold until September, and let's say September 1st. And then it didn't. The warranty didn't actually start until September 3rd because that was the date that the new owner took possession of the vehicle. So, it as of the 90s cars, late 90s and newer, that information is showing on there. So it has that. And then if there's been any transfer of ownerships, if there's been any warranty issues, accidents, most importantly, things like that. Now, there's another company out there called Instavin. Instavin's real good with giving you mechanical issues or updates, you know, when certain things were done, warranty changes, or if you took it into another repair shop and it's amazing how all this information is gathered, and I'll get into that in a second. And so what happens is some reporting agencies have just ownership transfer and accident reporting. Others have warranty claims. Well, Carfax will have that as well, but Instavin will have other things. You cracked your windshield and you filed an insurance claim and your windshield was replaced. You had a a major mechanical error, you know, an issue with the transmission, and it was reported and filed under a factory warranty claim, usually within 3 years. That will be on there. If you purchase the vehicle and you purchase it with a one of those aftermarket insurance policies that, you know, for like 3-4 years, that says, yeah, you know, we'll cover everything up to XYZ, 100,000 miles or something like that, that may show up on there. So things of that nature. But nonetheless, going back to storm. So if your car was totaled, more than likely, and I've talked to a number of people. In fact, I've got a guy that I'm talking to right now. He's got a 62 Bel Air or 62 Impala or something like that. And it was in the garage. It was flooded. He has Hagerty. Now, you all know that I'm not necessarily a big fan of Hagerty. However, Hagerty says, well, the car's fixable. And I will tell you from experience that if you're restoring a vintage car, you're 100% disassemble, 100% reassemble, you take it down to Wachula, Florida, and you have them basically dip it in their little baking soda solution or whatever they might have, and it seeps into all the creeks and crevices and all this kind of stuff, you might be able to flush out any rust, potential rust issues, and then of course you have to have the car dipped again and coated, okay, because when you go through that process, it gets into all the double panels and the double welded panels and stuff like that you can't get to if you're spraying a car, let's say, with primer and everything like that. And so that's the whole purpose of dipping a vehicle, so it gets into all the little creeks and crannies. And so anyway, saltwater car is a problem, particularly nowadays, if any of those vehicles have had electronics. I will tell you that, and I was at an auction a number of years ago, and there was a Porsche there that I looked at, and it was a really, really nice car, and I had a customer that was looking for one. So just, you know, we had some storms. It could have been in along the Mississippi. It could have been in Texas. It could have been up north, New York, wherever. When there's a storm, those cars disappear for a while, magically appear in different states and different auctions. You've got to be smart enough to check these vehicles out. Now, sometimes they get past the common ordinary eyeball, but if you're smart, you'll go down there and you'll just pull the carpeting away if you can a little bit. And some cars, you can do that. You can raise the carpeting up. Some are, you know, you got the trim, the sill panels that are there. And, you know, I mean, it looks kind of weird if you're unscrewing sill panels and trying to, you know, peel the carpeting back and see. However, in this particular case, it was a Porsche. But what it was I could pull the carpeting out and I could look underneath and I could see oxidation on the mechanical seat rails. And I said, this is a no-no. They didn't say anything. It went across the block under a green light, clear title, the whole nine yards, because they washed it from another state. And back in the day, you can kind of get away with that. Today, you can't. We have Carfax, right? Anyway, that was one instance. Another one was, there was a storm that was really, 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 really bad up in New York. Long story short, guy buys a 442 W30 convertible, right? Buys it. Now, the insurance company just paid out $180,000 in this car. I talked about this probably 7 or 8 or 9 years ago when this first happened. The guy buys the car. He lives over here in Tampa. He's an Oldsmobile guy. And he says, damn, this car's a saltwater car. He pays like $25,000 or $30,000 for the car. So he decides to hang it on the back of his rollback, dips it into his lake, lets it sit there for about 30 minutes or something like that, figuring it's going to get a good flush and a good soaking, right? Pulls it back out, cleans it up, looks at it real close, and this car is full of Bondo. And he says, wow, this car's not even worth fixing. Now, case in point, here's a car that looked really, really good. Insurance company insured it. I'm not sure who it was. For $180,000, that was the payout on that thing. So this guy buys it. He goes, man, this thing ain't worth fixing. So he fluffs it, puts a few little extra pieces in it, and he pedals it for another $60,000. So he's out of it, plus some profit. So the 62 Chevy that I'm looking at right now, they don't want to total it. They want to basically fix it. And so in this particular case, if you have a dispute with the insurance company, you can hire an outside appraiser. In this particular case, it's called the appraisal clause. So the insurance companies use inside adjusters. I'm not an adjuster. I'm an appraiser, which means I put valuations on vehicles. Okay, but I can do all that stuff. Anything an adjuster do, I can do, but I'm just not licensed to do that, so therefore I'm just an appraiser. So nonetheless, this guy can exercise the appraisal clause, which forces the insurance company to do the same thing, so they have to hire an outside appraiser, and then him and I go at it. And I usually have a lot more experience than most of these guys because this is what I do. And, you know, being a junkyard guy and all that other good stuff, it's pretty hard to beat me. And I write a pretty good report. And so anybody that you know out there that's had a car that's flooded is going to probably get wholesale. That's what the insurance company is going to offer them. Because they'll be writing a lot of checks. I mean, everything on the islands down here is flooded. I mean, you saw some of the pictures where they're just filled full of sand. You're not fixing that car. It's garbage. It's not even a good parts car. Certainly wouldn't want that rusty parts end up on fixing on ended up on ending up on your car. Bad deal. But anyway, so contact me at Nostalgic. No. GulfstreamMotorsports.com. If you have any questions, go to my website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, and you can find out and ask me, call me anytime, and I'll talk to you about how this whole insurance game, that's what I'm going to call it, works. On that note, we're going to play a little music, and then we're going to play a clip, and then we're going to bring our guest on. We have a very special guest coming on our show tonight. He's been on my show before. He's an alumni. He's a friend, and I'm looking forward to having him on the show. You're tuning into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
It's the bat phone.
To the bat balls. To the batmobile.
Hi, this is Bob Barshaw. You're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, we're back, and you're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. And you know that Led Zeppelin song, Good Times, Bad Times, that was one of my favorites. I think that came out in 1968. I was just a kid back then, but that is my all-time favorite Led Zeppelin song. In fact, we used to play that very, very early on in the show. Anyway, and of course, we used to watch Batman. This came out, and that was in 1966. Anyway, it's time to introduce my special guest. Gentlemen, you probably recognize this guy, and you've seen him 100 times, probably for, I don't know, years and years and years and years and years, 16 years, maybe more, longer than that. He was the on-deck, or if you will, on the floor, on the block, commentator. And he's also got a YouTube channel, and it's called Junkyard Corral. No, Junkyard Crawl. That's what it is. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show our good friend, Steve Magnante. Steve, how are you doing this evening?
Well, doing great, Robert. Basically, it's good to talk with you guys. And it was 19 years on Barrett Jackson. Crazy stuff. Me and Mike Joy were the dynamic duo up on the block describing the cars and giving them a voice for the 4 or 5 minutes while they were being auctioned. And then finally we get sold. Another car comes up. We do it all over again for 7 hours for 7 days in January at Scottsdale, the big show.
Wow. How'd you get that gig, by the way?
Well, it's funny. I used to write for car magazines and stuff. I did a thing called Hot Rod TV on Speed Channel way back when. And then there was an opening on the show, on the crew, for somebody to talk about muscle cars. And they said, hey, this guy writes for Hot Rod. Maybe he knows about muscle cars. And I was doing Hot Rod TV, so they could one-on-one together. And 19 years later, did it for that long, 19 years.
19 years, wow. Well, now, you uttered a word, muscle car. I was thinking about, you know, what would be a good topic to talk about, and or one of many, obviously. And muscle cars, that term. Now, when I think of a muscle car, I'm thinking 61, 62 Pontiac with a 421. I'm thinking a 409. I mean, a 409 Chevy. I'm thinking of a 406, 427 Galaxy, you know, something cool like that. Mustangs, Camaros, Cougars, Cudas, Plymouth Barracudas, or Challengers, rather. Those are pony cars. and fire chickens, obviously. And that's kind of how I perceive those. So, and then, of course, you got your Chevelles, and you got your Torinos, and then you got your Goats, and you got your, you know, and you're a big Mopar guy. You know, you got your GTXs and Satellites and Roadrunners and Chargers and whatever else is out there. So what's your take on that?
Well, you know, I agree. Basically, you know, for me, the engine is 95% of the situation.
Yes. So
you can have like a four-door Biscayne with a 427 police package, 1968 or 69, and that's a muscle car in my book. It's a big car. It's ponderous. It's big. But basically, a big engine, and particularly in a medium-sized car, the Pontiac GTO of 1964 was the first big engine in a smaller car. And that kind of laid the blueprint for what would follow with all the muscle cars of the 1960s.
Excellent. Now, anything in particular you're like, what do you have in your collection?
Well, I've sold a lot of stuff. I got encephalitis last August, and so it kind of changed things, which is okay. You know, with that said, I reset, sold all my cars and stuff like that, which is fine. But I've had a bunch of weird stuff in my driveway and shop over the years. My particular kink is altered wheelbase door slammers, like the late 1960s match racers that were very popular all over the Southeast and Midwest and even the Northeast, like Detroit and California a little bit. California is more about dragsters, not so much door slammers, but the altered wheelbase Dodge Corvettes, you know, people like Dick Landy, Sox and Martin, and all kinds of racers campaign these cars with the rear axle move forward about a foot, the front axle about 5 inches, and it was about traction and going in a straight line. They're pretty nasty creatures, and I built a few of them, the Rampage Dart, the Wilshire Shaker Nova, and even a Ford Fairmont. Yes, a Fairmont done up as a 60s funny car.
Whoa.
So that's my particular interest area. You know?
Well, now, we referred to those back in the day. The class, I believe, was AFX. They were altered. Right.
That is true. Absolutely. Factory experimental.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of mutated into the match race madness thing with nitromethane, hydrazine, Hillborn injection, and even superchargers. By 1967, tube frame chassis and fiberglass bodies replaced the steel frame or steel shelled door slammers. And the exhibition scene really exploded. People loved them, but with that said, the factories were no longer involved.
Well, let's see. Who do we have down in the South? The Georgia Shaker. He had a couple of those.
Oh, yes, Houston Platt. Right on Huber Platt. Yeah.
Huber Platt, right. And so, you know, you've got, you know, and I like nostalgia. Okay, I'm a huge vintage car guy. Okay, so those, in fact, they have a thing in Southeast here. It's called the Southeast Gassers. Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
I've never been to that. And I always thought gassers, straight axle cars, to me, just look so cool. I mean, I grew up in Northern Cal, okay? So in Northern Cal, it was not uncommon to have gassers running around on the street, street rods running around on the street, and obviously sports cars, because, you know, we had all the racetracks up that way, too, you know? And so you couldn't help. And then, of course, in the 60s, you know, growing up, we built models, you know? And, you know, I mean, it really was American Graffiti, and which I played that clip here at the beginning of the show. So what was it? And you're from where? You're from the Northeast, so you're like a Massachusetts, Connecticut kind of guy, New England?
Well, I am. Yeah, I was born in New York City. Don't hold that against me.
No.
But I lived in California for 17 years, and I moved back to Massachusetts about 10 years ago. And I liked L.A. I didn't love L.A. Sorry, Randy Newman. But it was very, very crowded.
Okay.
I love L.A. Well, I like L.A., but not enough to stay there. But 17 years was plenty there. But the highlight of my career really was working at Hot Rod Magazine for 7 years as tech editor and really having the opportunity to, indulge my interest in gassers and funny cars and super stockers and muscle cars also in the pages of Hot Rod by building project cars that resonated with the viewers and the readers, I should say.
Do a lot of them write in and say, hey, look, can you do a feature on this and a feature on that, or talk a little bit about more about this and more about that, you know, and car stuff and modifications and things like that?
Well, it's true. There is a lot of the reader feedback. It was called the mailbox, I think
yes.
It was. That's where people write in and say, hey, how about this or that? Usually to complain about something that one of us got wrong. Not that that ever happened, ever, never, no. But it was always fun to engage with the audience, and also going to car shows in Southern California was a great way to get a sense of what was hot in the hobby. But I was there when junkyard building was starting to take off, and in fact, I was part of the first car on the cover of Hot Rod in primer with bird poop on the windshield, and we didn't clean it off on purpose because we wanted to basically clean the slate and get back to a very basic vibe. Hot rodding starting with, you know, greasy knuckles and budget builds and getting away from, you know, billet parts and blister packs and having somebody else build it. So that was kind of a transition that was there when I got to Hot Rod, and I was happy to be a part of that.
Now, what year are we talking?
Well, I got there in 98 and stayed there for 7 years, so 98 through 2005-ish, somewhere around there. I did 77 issues of Hot Rod as the tech editor. You know, my editor, Roy McGonigal, and then David Freiberger.
I was just going to say, was Freiberger with you then?
He was, yeah. Roy was there for about 4 of my years, and then Freiberger for the last 2 years. I worked under him, and he, of course, is Freiberger, Finnegan, you know, the whole thing they do with...
Roadkill.
Good stuff. And but he's a guy who will work 25 hours a day. I'll do 23. he's a workaholic, and he does great things to magazines. He worked at CarCraft for a bunch of years. He brought it back from not the dead, but he gave it new life. Of course, magazines are kind of dead now with the internet, you know, taking over. And of course, Hot Rod is quarterly now. And that used to be, it was unthinkable, but there you have it. So the world changes, and you try to keep up with it no matter what you make.
Well, now, when you were there, so you worked under Freiberger?
Yes, he was the editor, and I was the tech editor.
Okay.
And there's a difference. The editor basically is the captain of the ship. Tech editor,
right.
You know, follows orders, come up with ideas. And, you know, I did everything from, like, LS1 intake manifold swaps, nitrous setups on 4.6 Mustangs, and, you know, the new Hemi engine when it came out. And, of course, you know, how to build an altered wheelbase funny car. We did that in 3 parts in Hot Rod. And we forced the viewers and the readers to endure that, and they loved it. It was a great thing to be able to, you know, not sway, but, you know, push certain agendas that were pure and historic and from the right place, and people loved that, I'm happy to say. Straight axle cars were another one of my favorite things, and Gashers for the Street, the El Monte Air Force, these guys in El Monte who built all straight axle cars, and it was a lot of fun to be a part of that whole scenario and fan the flames of change with looking back and looking forward at the same time.
Let me ask you a question. So, like, for example... Obviously, I talk about this all the time because I'm not only a car dealer, junkyard guy, used to be in the business and all that stuff, and an appraiser. I will be the first one to tell you that, hey, listen, I don't know everything there is to know about cars. I learn a lot. I take special interest in certain things, and I learn about those, and I get into it, eat, sleep, and drink those things, so I become one with whatever I'm getting into. So when you're an editor or tech editor, so obviously you don't know everything there is because you mentioned, well, I did this on a Chevrolet, I did this on a Ford, I did this on a Mopar, or I did this on a Toyota for all we know, and you know, which I get a kick out of the guys that put the V8s in the Teslas, which I'm all for that. And so do you basically have to take some time out to do? So Freiberg says, hey, Mike or Steve, go. We're going to do a feature on this car. I need you to bone up on this. I know you don't know squat about it. Or you know a little bit about it, but I got to get really, really smart about this stuff. So you got to go out and find a whole bunch of people that know this stuff, and you got to have them. You have to kind of like intellectually drain their brain so that you have all that information now, and then you can basically put it down on paper, and then eventually do a build. Is that kind of how it works?
Well, I will say that a little bit of research goes a long way.
Oh yes,
and also in that building, from Motor Trend to CarCraft to Rod and Custom to Hot Rod, we had a brain trust of people who could answer any question pretty much you might have. And this is before, you know, Google and the internet was just coming on at that point in time in 1998. So, you know, we had a research library, and a lot of it, you know, we just were steeped in that stuff, the history of it from day one. And Freiberger is a you know, a hot rodder's hot rodder, basically. And, you know, I can keep up with him, for sure. You know, I built my own engines and stuff, did welding and whatnot. But, you know, you kind of bone up on whatever you have to write about and become an instant expert, and then on to the next instant expert.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, those magazines back then, they were all part of what? Peterson's Publications, correct?
That's right. Bob Peterson, who founded everything in 1948, Hot Rod, and of course Motor Trend in 49, and it grew from strength to strength. I mean, he was like probably a billionaire. I mean, who knows what, but he did very well buying, you know, real estate in Los Angeles, Hollywood, had an airline. Peterson, he was like an executive airline, had jets and stuff, so he did really well for himself. And, you know, we did okay working for the magazines, but not a good way to get rich, but it was good for the soul. Wonderful to have been part of that.
Did you ever get? Was he still around when you were there?
You know, I'd see him in the elevator once in a while. He had a suite on the top of the building, and he'd be once in a while you'd see him, but that was the, you know, you'd say hello, company parties, and there you'd be. But he was kind of scarce. You know, he didn't really have much to do with the day-to-day operations anymore.
Okay. Did you when you're in L.A. there? I'm not sure exactly. I know where the Peterson Museum is, okay, roughly. And where in relationship were you to the old Peterson Museum?
Well, same side of the street, about a half a mile down.
Oh, really?
6420 Wilshire Boulevard.
Wilshire Boulevard.
And, it was a 22-story building, and I had an 11th floor office on the corner, which was nice to have the view of Wilshire Boulevard and all the people driving by. But it was really quite an interesting. The only bummer was driving from El Monte, California, 31 miles to Wilshire Boulevard, 2.5 hours each way, twice a day.
No way. Traffic was that bad?
Yeah. Well,
was it the 408 or what? Which you or 405?
405, 605, 405, 210, 110, all of them just a spaghetti bowl. And the big problem was anytime there's an interchange between one freeway and another one, everything is ground to a halt as people jockeyed for permission. So you had to give yourself 2 hours, 2.5 hours to get to work. Or leave at 5 and get there at 9. Oh. It got old.
No.
I did it for 7 years, you know.
Dang. So did you, I mean, there was a lot of hot rods. SoCal was there. So did you go out and hang out at some of those places? You get to go meet a lot of the cool people that were Alex Exidius there, Pete Chaporos, I'm trying to think of everybody. Chip sat at his place over in Huntington. Did you get to kind of hang out at those kind of places a lot?
Well, you know, I didn't really. My thing mostly was, going to the diner, like at West Tech Performance, John Bechtel and the guys there. Basically, they had a Chevy 409 in the diner. We'd do some testing on intake manifolds. And Edelbrock bought out aluminum 409 heads. Amazing. The 409 Chevy engine got a breath of life again because Edelbrock did cylinder heads in aluminum. Crazy. But when that would happen, I'd go there, do a full story on it, talk to the engineers. They'd have sliced and diced heads that they'd used as a benchmark when they made their aluminum castings. So that was my bailiwick. Not so much going to a place where shiny, pretty cars like, you know, Troy Trepanier, of course, Chip Foose, those kind of guys. I never really crossed paths with them because they were either far away or it was a different kind of story. We'd send a professional photographer in a lighting truck to go make those shoots and those pictures. I was more about just a tripod and a good camera and just hold it steady and get the shot.
Take us through
of the cam.
Okay. Take us through the process. Okay, so now, for example, you've got to... did you have, like, deadlines? In other words, Freiberger would say, hey, look, I need a story on this. Of course, now that I'm improvising here. A coyote swap. Let's just say a 4.6 swap into an old vintage Mustang or something like that with a Tremec. And so you had to come out with, because the publication was monthly, correct?
Yes.
Back in those days. So how much?
Never missed a month.
What was your time frame? So from the start to finish, from the time you were handed your assignment, how long did it take you to get that thing ready for print?
Well, the way that stories got figured out, we'd have staff meetings, you know, all the tech editors, the feature editors, about five of us. And Gray Baskerville, quite a, the beloved, you know, late Gray Baskerville, but he was a legend and is a legend, continues to be, although he passed away about, I guess, 10 years ago. But we would all brainstorm, would be a good story, let's do this one. Some guy has a car or a new product or whatever. When the Hemi came out, the 5.7, the Gen 3, and of course the LS motors, the modular motors, those were all new things in 1998 when I got there to Hot Rod. So it was like a revolution of brand new metal, space age, 21st century, overhead cam Fords, and of course the pushrod Hemis and LS motors were just miracle motors that pretty much made mincemeat of the stuff that they replaced. It's amazing that happened. But anyway, so we'd find out what's hot. We'd get a thing called a run sheet. We'd all get an assignment. You know, I'd get the stories on camshaft swaps, axle ratio changes, drag testing. And then Jeff Koch would get the pretty cars, the feature stories. He'd go find the car and get a place to shoot it and light it and stuff like that. That was a whole different department. But then we'd have the 3 months between the time we shot the story and it would wind up on the newsstand. 3 months. That was a lead time for the printing process. So it was kind of a thing that really killed the paper industry because, again, Daytona 500 coverage was 3 months old by the time it hit the pages of Hot Rod. And that's been a problem with Hot Rod ever since the beginning of Daytona in the early 60s when Hot Rod would cover it. And, of course, Motor Trend would cover it a little bit. But that's the thing. The lead time is a problem, really, in a lot of ways. But, of course, the Internet, you can get the information instantly as it happens. So they all work hand in hand.
So what's your thought on the fact that, you know, publication, or I don't want to use, I'm just going to use this cliche, print is dead. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I won't argue. I won't argue with that.
Really?
You know, there's a couple of magazines that are still going. You know, Chevy, All Chevy Performance. That's a good publication. That's a smaller printing company. It's a niche, you know, but they have circulation. I don't think I find them at Walmart. That's usually a benchmark right there if Walmart has them. But, you know, little by little, chain stores like Walmart and, you know, Walden Books and, you know, all bookstores, they pretty much, they narrowed down their magazine racks to minimal. There's like maybe 10, you know, automotive subjects or, you know, topics on the newsstand at any time. So that's dying for sure. But, you know, online fills in the gaps. I do miss the tactile experience of grabbing a magazine, putting it in my back pocket, and, you know, going to a restaurant and opening the magazine and reading my magazine with my dinner.
Yep.
You know, it's harder to do when you have a laptop or a screen in your face. And I don't know, it's not quite the same.
No, I get
60,
it.
So what do I know?
Hey, listen, we have a chain of stores here. It's called Publix, right? So every once in a while, my wife drags me in there, you know. So what do? I go down that little aisle there where they have the magazines and stuff. And there's a Hemmings there, and there's a Road and Track, and there's a couple of, and I, you know, we're old school, so yeah, I pick it up and I sit there, and my wife goes, are you done yet? Well, I don't buy them anymore, because what I do is I look at the information in there, and then basically I might take a picture with my phone, and then I go home and I look it up. I mean, but, you know, because the problem is I just don't have the real estate to store all these magazines like I used to, and throwing them away kills me.
I hear you. Yes, I have the same problem.
You feel my pain.
Yes.
All right, so let's talk about the Barrett Jackson gig. How'd that come about for you?
Well, it basically grew out of my thing with Speed Channel doing Hot Rod TV, mm-hmm. and they said, hey, let's try this guy in the Palm Beach auction, see how it goes, and I didn't wet my pants, you know, it went well, and, you know, that was 19 years ago.
Wow,
and,
that's right.
I did find that, you know, the thing of it is, basically, is just to give the car a voice for the 4 minutes that it's on the block. Don't try to write a book, because you don't have time, because they sell the next one, and then next thing you're explaining what a flathead Ford is, and it's an hour later, and meanwhile, you know, they've gone to commercial 10 times, and, you know, you're fired. You can't do that. So you have to be smart. Just work smart and be a sniper with the information. And then when the auctioneer is doing his thing, you don't step on him. Let him do his thing. When he goes, sold, just shut up and move on. You know.
So when are you kind of giving instructions? So are you like said, okay, so we got this, you just use a 69 A12 car, right? That's a liftoff six-pack car. So your job is to just kind of like highlight some of the features of that particular car, correct?
Well, that's true. You know, we have a roving cameraman. There's actually two camera guys on the stage right there. And so basically when the car is on the block, and the way we know what's coming up is we do have there's a sheet that shows, you know, what lot windows will be on TV during our air window. There you go. So basically I'll bone up a little bit in advance, sometimes make notes, but usually just go with what's printed on the windshield of the car. The consigner will sometimes, you know, give descriptions of what's on it and just bring those things to life and then point, oh, there's the pins, no hood hinges on this thing. It's got pins all the way around. It's a fiberglass. It's a liftoff, and, you know, don't expect to have a place to put it when it's off, because otherwise the wind will blow it away. That happens a lot. Fiberglass hoods are the enemy of pretty paint. But that's how it kind of goes, you know, automatic or four-speed or whichever one it might be. Dana 60 rear axle on all of them, even the automatic cars, et cetera, et cetera. And if you can get the camera down low to show what a Dana 60 looks like versus an 8 3/4, which is a different type of axle, then it's all the better, because the viewer goes, oh, that's the difference. Now I know. So that's the kind of thing. Give the car a voice.
Okay. Give us an example of one of the craziest, most unusual cars you've ever seen. And let's stick with muscle cars. Let's stick with collector cars, not no street rods and, you know, something that was thrown together in some guy's shop and just had a pretty paint job. I'm talking about a real car.
Yeah, I will say this. A couple of weeks ago, I was at the Eastern States Exposition, and there was a 66 Pontiac GTO. It was a factory lightweight. Yes, they made them with no there's carpeting, but there's no jute backing, no undercoating, nothing. Had the tri-power. I think 210 of these things were built. Functional Ram Air hood with it's a metal insert that goes into the hood. They cut it out at the factory. 391 gears, and get this, aluminum brake drums up front, which were absolutely a GTO option because the stock drums were like 9.5 inches in diameter, not very big, But Pontiac said, let's do some aluminum drums and make those available, even on six-cylinder cars if you wanted. But this thing had the aluminum drums up front, which caught my eye. Beautiful red car, tri-power four-speed close ratio, the original window sticker, beautiful restoration. So wow. That was something that really blew my mind, you know. And this, you know, that's just, I mean, where does it go? 63 Super Duty Catalina with the aluminum front bumper and front fenders. And, you know, the links that car makers went to reduce weight, you know, aluminum doors on the 64 race Hemis and stuff. Aluminum door, what? How vulnerable would that be? How easily dented? But that kind of exotica, not just for Ferraris. You can find that on muscle cars and factory experimental cars. Thunderbolts, the 427 Fairlanes, cool stuff.
The drums, were they aluminum drums? Were they finned by any chance?
They like were finned, oh yes. Same idea, but not 12 inches. You know, the Buick front and rear drums were needed because those, you know, Rivieras or, you know, whatever.
Big, Wildcat, heavy, yeah.
Yeah, like almost, you know, 5 tons with a full load of people and baggage in a truck, you know, on a long tour. And you needed some big drums that would dissipate the heat. Now, on the GTO and the Pontiac Tempest and Le Mans, these things are only 9.5 inches in diameter, maybe right. 2.5 inches wide. But again, had the same, it was an iron wear surface that was cast into the aluminum housing. And they work, but they catch your eye from a mile away. Oh, look at those things. They're beautiful.
Interesting.
And it's just exotic, weird stuff that most people don't even think about. But it was, I think, a $12 option. It was cheap on the GTO.
Well, even go ahead.
There's even a convertible frame option, which was, I think, $8, which consisted of boxed side channels, and it made it a stiffer, more rigid platform upon which to put the body and bang gears and go drag racing. But weird stuff like that.
Wasn't that standard on all the big block A-bodies, the box frames?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think so. You paid extra. If you had a convertible, yes, the side beams were definitely boxed, and those are heavier, like by about 150 pounds than a regular C-channel frame. But you could pay extra. It wasn't much. I think $12. It wasn't a lot of money. But the big block cars didn't necessarily have the box frame. Well, they didn't have extra reinforcements over the rear axle, kind of where the coil springs live. So if you see one of those in a junkyard, take a peek.
Well, you're talking about the aluminum drums. I mean, another option that I liked on Pontiacs I thought was really, really cool was the eight lug wheels. Remember those?
Yes, absolutely. Beautiful. Yep.
And now, I don't know, was that ever available on Pontiac, on an intermediate, like a, you know, an A-body, a GTO or anything like that, or Le Mans?
You know, magazine ads sometimes launch 1,000 incorrect ships. Pontiac had a magazine ad, I think in Superstock, they showed like a plum, sort of a Royal Plum GTO going around test track with the 8-lug wheels on it. Now, those were never introduced or released for general consumption. They're always in the full-size cars. So, you know, unless some engineers, you know, but people saw those ads, man, I want to get away to 8 lugs for my GTO. Doesn't happen. And they were, you know, only 14-inch rims, no 15s, kind of crazy. But there were companies that make adapter kits to put them on the other cars. But the aftermarket has stepped up and done all kinds of crazy stuff that didn't exist back in the day because people want it. So 8 lugs on smaller Pontiacs, yes, possible, but not from the factory.
Interesting. You know what I always thought was kind of odd, too, is that you would have thunk, if you want to use that term, slang.
I like it.
If we would have thunk back in the day that more people would have ordered stick shifts, and that used to amaze me. And, in fact, I'll tell you what, it used to kill me because a friend of mine, and a big shout-out to the guys over there and my friends over at Hollywood Wheels, Mike had an A12 car column shift.
Yeah.
Power windows, bench seat, automatic. And I'm thinking to myself, who would order that? But then a friend of mine down the street had a 68X, GTX, bucket seats, no buddy seat in the middle, column shift, J-code Hemi. With,
wow.
Black with a blue interior. And I just thought, why would you? And then, of course, the perception was, it's just meant to go down the track. It's just meant to go a quarter mile at a time. Yeah. And so I guess, you know, and of course, you know, automatics were kind of like the thing back in the late 60s and the early 70s because they were a little quicker. But, you know, you look at Mr. Grumpy Jenkins and Landy, you know, Mr. Four-Speed and all those other guys that were out there. And I'm trying to think who else. Al Joniak, you know, people like that who raced. They were all four-speed guys. And they could shift just as quick as an automatic. Almost.
You know, Ronnie Socks. I mean, right. Like, as quick as an automatic, a full manual valve body automatic. Ding, ding, ding.
You know, Okay. But, you know, but a lot of it was getting out of the hole, too.
Yeah.
You know, so it's reaction time. And so if you launch and you're gone, that was the game over. So
you could use the stored energy of the flywheel. You know, wind the engine to 6 grand, dump the clutch, and if nothing breaks, you're going to get a hole shot on the automatic next year, unless you miss a gear on the way down the track, and then the automatic will keep up and run past you. So, yeah, they both have their place.
Yes, but nothing beats a four-speed. Are you a four-speed guy or an automatic guy? You're a four-speed guy, right?
Both. Most of my hot rods have had automatics because they're maintenance. They're great maintenance. Torque flight transmission, 727 with the B&M shift kit or an art car, you know, manual valve body. They work great. Reverse pattern, hopefully. And there's no kickdown linkage, none of that stuff to mess with. If you have headers on the car, kickdown is a pain in the behind. So that whole thing. So just a manual valve body. So you just push the buttons,
yep,
or click the shifter and clink, 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 and screech, bang. Or bang, screech, I should say.
Something like that, yeah. Let's talk about junkyard crawl. Now, that's not where you got bit by this strange bug that kind of put you away for a year or so, is it?
Well, I think so. I gave it the office and how. You know, just to rewind a little bit, one of the things when I was in California, see, I'm from Massachusetts originally, and out here in Massachusetts, everything is rusted within 5 years. You see people with pickup trucks, brand new pickup trucks, still have a payment book, and the bed is rotting away because the salt here is a liquid stuff they spray down. It's not sand. It's not crusty. It's actually a liquid that gets everywhere.
Wow.
So a couple of winters of that, and your car is paper thin. You know, it's a non-factory lightweight, if you know what I'm saying. So anyway, after growing up with that, when I got to California, nothing rusts out there. I mean, minimal. There's surface rust, but nothing structural that just, you know, blew my mind. So I started doing magazine articles for Carcraft and Hot Rod, the junkyard crawl is what we called them. I go into the junkyard, just take pictures of, oh my gosh, what a shame. Look at this, you know, clean 65 Bonneville, and it's going to get crushed sometime soon, and what a shame. So that became a TV show called Roadkill's Junkyard Gold. We went all over the country looking for cars, and we did 31 episodes of that. And then it came to an end, and they canceled it. And not because it wasn't received well, because the budget was used on bigger projects like Kevin Hart's Muscle Car Crew, wink, wink.
Oh.
And that absorbed the funding for smaller shows like Dirt Every Day and Junkyard Gold. So I said, you know what, I'm going to make my own YouTube channel, Steve Miotti's Junkyard Crawl, which I didn't have to answer to anybody, and that was a dream come true until I got encephalitis, probably in the junkyard. A flea tick or a mosquito bite, for sure.
I was just going to say, what we ought to do is let the listeners know that up in New England, they have these giant flies, and they also have a lot of ticks. And if you get bit by anything weird like that, and they seem to train, and mosquitoes and all the other stuff, never mind the snakes, and you can get Lyme disease, and Lyme disease can get, you know, really mess you up, and not to mention in your case, you got encephalitis. So. Obviously a very painful thing. But you know what, Steve? We're all glad you're healthy and you're happy and you're back here and you're on the air and you're doing fine and you're doing what you love. That's the most important thing.
Correct. Yes. I was in a coma for 3 months. It was news to me. I was like, huh? I wasn't even there. But it's kind of a weird thing. It was a brain swell, and they gave me a brain biopsy, a little drill, a core drill. And I said, hey, before you weld it, Joe, you put a peanut M&M in there so I have a snack for later. It's actually peanut butter M&M is better because it melts. But it definitely, you know, that was something that was not in the script by any stretch, encephalitis. So it kind of turned everything upside down. But I'm still here, still alive. And that's a good thing.
So what's the game plan? So what are you working on now?
Well basically, there's a place called High Octane Classics in Auburn, Mass. They buy and sell muscle cars, collector cars, everything from Porsches to Plymouths, to everything in between. So once a week I go in there and I do like 5 or 6 walk-around videos, which keeps my brain sharp and me talking to a camera. And it's basically like a tightrope walk. We do them in one take. Might be a couple bloopers, but for the most part, one rip. And then that keeps me going. And then in November, I'll be in Bakersfield for Hot Rod Garage, narrating with Casey Jones, the Hot Rod Garage drags up at Formosa Drag Strip in Bakersfield, which is a historic track.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll be there in November. That'll be my first kind of out performance, you know, with an audience, a real audience of people who, you know, I think will be there to see drag racing and will just give the cars a voice as they run their way down the quarter mile.
Super. Well, your fans will be there, everybody. Speaking of which, you mentioned Bakersfield. I don't know if you ever experienced this in any of your writings or anything like that, but they used to talk about the car guys that were building cars in Southern Cal, the car guys that were building cars where I'm from, the Bay Area, the car guys that were building cars in Bakersfield, the car guys that were building cars in New York, the car guys that were building cars in Michigan, the car guys that were building cars in New England. You know, and I'll use Rhode Island because Rhode Island was, you know, Tasca and everything like that. But was there, did you ever run across where, I mean, to me, they called it, every one of these places geographically had a style. I never really looked at it as a style unique to, because it came from Southern Cal or Michigan or New England or Washington State or Florida or Illinois or someplace like that. I mean, have you ever bumped into that?
Well, I will say this. There's a certain cliquishness, if you
okay.
will. Generally speaking, California stuff was most presentable. You know, there were pretty cars because they could be driven and worked on year-round. Whereas in the New England or the Rust Belt, you put your car away in the wintertime, maybe you worked on it, but you did not cruise it in the winter unless you wanted it to rot away.
Hmm.
So the execution, the amount of chrome plating, and of course, you know, the budgets, California a little more lucrative and more affluent, if you will, the aerospace industry, and just good place to be. I mean, the economy is strong everywhere. Well, in some places, stronger than others. But the Eastern cars were generally they were known for being crude. A guy named A.B. Schumann, who wrote for Motor Trend and did a book called Cool Cars, Square Roll Bars.
Huh.
That sums it up. Roll bars, like square,
yeah.
Nothing elegant, but they were satisfied the NHRA, you know, rulemakers to go down the drag strip in, you know, 10 seconds at maybe, you know, 140 miles an hour back when a Buick Nailhead with a bunch of, you know, two-barrel carburetors or whatever would be a big deal.
Yeah, six Strombergs.
Yes, there you go, like at 97s or yes. But Cool Car, Square Roll Bars, A.B. Schumann, great book. And he kind of has, it's a picture, a photo essay of just, you know, some raunchy but down and dirty, you know, mass New England hot rods from Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York State even, there's a lot of that. But it is true that the further west you went, the more chrome you saw, and, you know, maybe the higher level of workmanship, if you will, because they had, you know, the aerospace industry, better welding and, you know, chrome plating and stuff like that, which are, you know, rare things. Gas welded dragsters in New England until the 70s, really. Finally, arc welding and TIG welding became a thing. But a lot of things that happened, you know, the magazines would sometimes spread trends all over the country that might have started in California. So it was kind of a crossbreeding of ideas and execution and a big melting pot called hot rodding.
Well, Steve, we're up against the clock, and I want to really thank you for hanging out with us. If people want to find out more about you, and we'll have to do this again, I'll have to get you on here periodically, you know, just so I have someone that can tell me, you know, you're out and you travel a lot, and I kind of like to see what you guys got going on and get your feedback and your pulse on what's going on. But if people want to find out more about you, how do they go about doing it, Steve?
Well, I have a YouTube channel that's still, it's in autopilot. No new videos since they went into the hospital, but it's in reruns, and it's just called The Junkyard Crawl. There's about 200 videos if you want to get your fill of me walking around the junkyard, getting encephalitis. No, I'm kidding. Maybe. I don't know. But you can find that on YouTube. It's free. It's free. You can check it out anytime.
Super.
24 hours.
Well, Steve, you take care. I'm sure I'm going to bump into you somewhere, either between here, California, SEMA, someplace like that, sooner or later. But and if you ever come to Florida, definitely look us up, see it on the show or something like that. But in the meantime, thanks a lot for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. And all the best
to
you.
Thank you for taking up me.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Take care, buddy. And you have a big fan club down here. And a big shout out to Pete, because I know Pete was listening tonight. So Pete and Hank and Brandon and everybody, they wanted to hear Steve. So, Steve, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, take care, buddy. Hey, I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't forget to check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tan Talk Radio Network. Follow us on social media, Nostalgic Radio and Cars, Gulfstream Motorsports. Got anybody out there that's got a car that needs to be totaled or is going to get totaled, have them call me up. Look us up, GulfstreamMotorsports.com. We'll take care of that for them. Festival Speed will be there. Big shout-out to my old buddies at Cop Cars Online. If you want a cop car, those are the guys. In the meantime, get out there, drive your cars, stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.